This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp. How's your social battery doing right now? I've never used that phrase, but I instantly know what it means. And I think it's interesting because it works two different ways. Some people need to have their social battery charged, and they this is the introvert extrovert thing. And some people, you know, like they've got enough energy for other people, but then it's time to sort of step away. And, you know, as we get to this part where winter is ending, which again, it's opposite. I love winter. I don't need it to end. You know, you start getting together with more people and it can be a little draining on top of every other thing that we all have going on in our lives. I just assume everybody's overburdened because I think everybody's overburdened, but it can be tough to deal with. And also one of the things is like, you can't necessarily understand why you feel that way or why it's making you tired, but it's a real thing. If you think that you could use some help with it, if you could figure out a way to make things better, therapy is a great way to help. It can give you that kind of self-awareness to know how to ride that level just right so that you feel good, you feel right. If you're thinking of starting therapy, you can give BetterHelp a try. It is entirely online. It is designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule, which is, again, we've been talking about being busy, right? You got to fit that in. You got a lunch period. You can do it during that time, whichever. That's possible. You fill out a brief questionnaire and get matched with a licensed therapist. You can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. I like that. There is no penalty for finding the person who is right for you. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/iFanboy today. Get 10% off of your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/iFanboy.
You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
You are listening to Talksplode from iFanboy.com. I am Josh Flanagan. Today we are talking to Joe Kelly, writer of many comics, including I Kill Giants, Four Eyes, Bang Tango, Bad Dog, the recently released Douglas Fredericks and the House of They, as well as a run on Amazing Spider-Man. We're going to talk to Joe about his whole career, all the books he's got coming out, his work with Man of Action, and plenty of stuff in between. We are here with Joe Kelly. I am Josh Flanagan from iFanboy.com. I'm here with Paul Montgomery.
Hello.
And how you doing, Joe?
I'm good, thanks. How are you guys?
Very good. You know, it's funny because I've been wanting to do a sort of longer interview with you for a while because you've had just so many things coming out recently that have really struck a chord with people. Do you feel like I don't want to put this the wrong way, but do you feel like there's a bit of a resurgence going on in comics with you?
Yeah, I know what you're saying. I mean, for a while I was focused a lot on animation, mm-hmm. and writing a lot of scripts and story editing a couple of shows. So for a while I'd kind of, you know, just by necessity kind of pulled back from comics. So during that time though, I was always pecking at these other projects. And what's kind of funny is that these things were not written remotely near one another, but they all came out at the same time. So it really was this accidental wave of like, here's a ton of new stuff for me. Mm-hmm. But it was just more necessity than anything else because I was pecking on these things on the side while I was doing the other stuff.
And so you've fooled us all, basically.
Yes, exactly. It looks like I wrote 10 books in 2 months, but really it's been like a side project for years.
Well, are you working on stuff coming out, or do you feel like it's like going to create a vacuum going forward, or are you feeling like you're under pressure to bring a bunch more stuff?
Yeah, I definitely feel the pressure, but it's good pressure, and the nice part about it is that the Bad Dog and Four Eyes are both ongoing, even though they come out sporadically, which I have all sorts of apologies about for that, but Giants is its own thing, Douglas is its own thing, and Bang Tango is about to wrap up, and then of course there's Spider-Man. So I feel like there's plenty of stuff to kind of keep us afloat while the next things are being worked on, which are actually being worked on, which is cool.
Well, let's go back to the beginning, and I just wanted to ask about, I guess, some of the early bits in your career. From what I can see, you started sort of in the same way, similar to Brian K. Vaughan. I guess you were in a workshop or a class or something like that. Can you explain that?
Sure, yeah. It was it was nicknamed the Stan Hatton Project, but the couple of editors from Marvel at the time, Mark Powers and James Felder, they were looking for new talent, so they contacted NYU's Department of Dramatic Writing, where I happen to be a graduate assistant. And the letter was sort of sitting on the head of the department's desk, and her secretary suggested that I, you know, take a look at it because it was about comics, and there was an excellent chance it was just going to end up in the circular file. So I stole it and read it and said, hey, you know what, I'd like to volunteer for that Marvel thing. And that was sort of it. The guys came in, and we did about a 10 or 12 week course, and they took us through dialogue all the way back up to series construction. And through the course of that, they liked what I was doing, so that's how I got my work. And I was the first year, which I guess was 96, and then Brian was the next year. 97 came out of the same program. And then that class has actually evolved, even though I don't think they did it after I graduated, but I actually teach that class now as an official class at NYU in the summers, although the last two summers have been Eddie Brigand is doing it right now from D.C., and Will Dennis did it last summer.
Who do you? Wow, do you know anybody else who's working who's come out of those classes?
No, not yet. Some of the guys who I've, you know, I teach that comics class and writing for animation, and a couple of my animation guys have gotten some work, but I don't know off the top of my head of any other comic guys who have gotten work yet.
Oh, interesting. So when you were, when you were in school, like, had you been interested? I mean, what were you in school for? Had you wanted to write comics before that?
I was actually in for screenwriting was my focus. And it was a really, you know, happy, glorious accident that I was in the right place and right time for this comics thing. Because I like comics fine. I was definitely a fan, and I was collecting at the time, mostly Vertigo stuff. But that's what I was reading. So to have a chance to do it, it wasn't what I had planned on doing, but it was writing, and it was directly applicable to what I was doing. I mean, that program is dramatic writing, so it's not prose, it's not poetry, it's not any of that stuff. It's writing scripts and you know, writing visually, which is what we were taught, you know, in screenwriting, is obviously directly applicable to a comic. So it was really perfect timing and a happy place to be.
It's interesting because, I mean, did you feel it at all at any point? Because you basically started writing comics from almost that point on. I mean, did you feel like you derailed your screenwriting career, or were you just like, oh, this is good, I'll go with this?
You know, I don't know. It's funny. You look back at, like, the roads you could have traveled and that sort of thing, and there were definitely opportunities that I don't know, I didn't really get that deep into because I was busy doing comics, but I was having a great time. So much stuff happened sort of at the same time. Like, I graduated, I got married, and was working on the X-Men, like, literally within a month of each other. Mm-hmm. And I really had no complaints. I mean, of the people I graduated with, you know, maybe a handful of us were actually being paid to write. Mm-hmm. It's such a, you know, it's such a long haul and such a competitive business anyway. So I was really just happy to be doing it. But, you know, I've never really regretted it. I mean, there are times where I go, like, oh, yeah, maybe I could have done certain things earlier. But honestly, those things are happening now. And I, you know, sort of in a roundabout way, did get involved in screenwriting and animation through comics. So it all worked out.
Did you have to? I mean, a lot of people, you know, breaking into comics is sort of a long and difficult process for a lot of people. But it sounded like it kind of just dropped in your lap and you went with it. I mean, did you have more of a dues paying process, do you think, that we don't know about, or?
No, I was really, really lucky. It's, like, embarrassingly lucky. And when I talk to people who are trying to get into the industry, and I sort of tell them, you know, what I'm sort of told by editors, you know, and every couple of years they sort of have a different version of, like, oh, pitch me, don't pitch me, give it to me in writing, tell me verbally, you know, whatever. And when I tell them, they're like, oh, is that what you did? And I always have to shake my head and be like, you know, I went a different route. And I don't know. I mean, the dues paying process, you pay dues in other ways.
Sure.
Kind of once you're in the door and you start to develop your own voice and you actually want to tell stories, not just sort of regurgitate, you know, stuff that's come before or that's being handed to you, that's where your dues paying really comes in. You know, once you want to kind of plant your flag. that's when you really got to pay dues. So, you know, there's, I was lucky to get in the way I did, but there was a different kind of process once you're in the door.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it's, I guess, that much different now? I mean, because now it seems like there's a lot of guys and they come up through doing indie stuff. It's very rare for the most part for guys to just pop into Marvel or DC without having done much comics or anything before that. I mean, do you see that kind of change going on in the industry from when you started?
Yeah, I mean, the only there aren't that many projects that they can take a chance on a new writer with, although I there might be a trend starting to go back to that. I mean, like, DC's starting to do a lot more holiday specials where there are short story opportunities for new writers and for people to get tried out. But, yeah, for the most part, I think what we're seeing is a lot of folks who have experience in other media certainly getting a crack, and then guys who have really proven themselves on the indie front and are good self-promoters, which is, you know, like 99% of the battle. You know, getting that editor's attention and really getting them to take you seriously. And that's tough because so many of us are introverts.
Yeah.
We're like, we just want to do our thing and like put out our cool comics and hope that, you know, everybody loves us. But if we don't stand up and yell a little bit.
Yeah, I think that we all just related to each other just there. That was really good.
It's true, man. I tell you, it's I don't know if I was ever like a mega shy guy, but I was certainly quiet in my way. And then I was sort of forced really early on to start to open my mouth because of comics. Mm-hmm. You know, the first time you go to a Marvel retreat and people are like, so what do you want to do on the X-Men? And you're like, 30 heads turn at you. You got to learn very quickly. You better open your mouth and speak up. And speaking on panels in front of people, you know, those things taught me to open my mouth and, you know, also tell me I had something to say, which is comforting too. But obviously, a lot of people don't get that opportunity, and it's tough. I mean, that's probably the advice I give to young writers almost more than anything else, because you assume that they can write or that they're working really hard at their craft. But teaching them to sell themselves and, you know, be comfortable speaking to people—that's mm-hmm. a challenge for a lot of guys.
So you're suggesting that, say, a podcaster would be a good route.
I think that's a fine route. Yeah. Used to speak. This is a good thing, you know, not afraid.
Yeah, no, just terrified as long as you don't show it. So how old were you when you got your first, when you were, I guess Deadpool was your first regular series. So how old were you then?
God, how old was I? I guess it was about, I'm trying to think that, I mean, I was working at Marvel for a couple of months, I guess, when Deadpool came along. I started in 96 off and on, so we'll say it was 97. So I guess that I was 26.
Okay.
Yeah.
And it's funny because, you know, talking about the way that the industry now as opposed to then, like, you kind of had to learn on the job.
Absolutely, yeah.
I mean, when you look back at the stuff that you did back then, do you recoil? Do you like some of it? Do you ever look at it?
Yeah, you know, it's fine. As a general rule, I don't tend to look back at stuff, which is kind of another version of the being shy. You know, it's like, it's too real. Now I have to look at it and be like, oh my God, it was so bad. But I've never looked back. It's something I've actually had to cultivate over the last couple of years, you know, especially like working in animation where you really got to see how the show came out. You know, you can't like write the script and just assume it was glorious, you know, because it was written down on paper. You need to see like what people did and didn't do and that sort of thing. With comics, because you're there with almost every step of the process, it's almost like tough to look at that final printed book for me because, you know, I've seen it 5 times already. But I don't know, occasionally I look back at something. I was actually just rereading that Action 775, and
I have a question about that.
Oh, okay. But you know, and I was shocked kind of like how much more action there was in my mind than actually on the page, which mm-hmm. kind of cracked me up. But no, it's good. You know, I more gauge it by fans. You know, people come up to me and tell me that they liked a certain book or they just discovered like my Deadpool and that sort of thing. So a lot of it holds up over time, which makes me really happy and proud. But yeah, you evolve, and, you know, as a writer, no doubt you learn new tricks, you forget tricks, you know, or I tend to get obsessed with themes for a while that become really, you know, apparent in the work and, or things that I was just kind of like muddling my way through in my head. So it's cool to look back and sort of see those things play out, but I can't honestly say I do it very often.
Speaking, I guess, of sort of the Deadpool and stuff like that. So that was your first series. Was that a character who you knew anything about, or did you want that, or was it handed to you and you had to like get to know Deadpool?
Well, again, in the sort of kooky way that my career went, I was doing a couple of little things like What Ifs and Marvel Presents and that sort of thing, and I was actually starting on Daredevil because Carl was finishing up his run, and they were looking to kill some time, I think, before Kevin Smith came in a little bit later. But and then Matt Idelson asked me about Deadpool. We had done some What Ifs together, and he's like, they're talking to me about this book. It's this weird character. Like, I don't know if it's going to last, and why not take a pitch for it? I want to try some new blood. So I did, and somehow managed to get it. Like, I still don't entirely understand the process, but the pitch was insane. Like, we were talking about having Deadpool fight Obnoxio the Clown and Ego the Living Planet. It was really like a bizarre pitch. And at the time, the Heroes Reborn universe is going on. And so like the major through line of the whole first year was that he had that blue ball and didn't know what was in it and didn't understand why people kept trying to kill him. Like, he had the entire Marvel universe in his hand. Of course, that none of that went through. But what was great was that, once they said, hey, you got some cool ideas, take a shot at it, really, in the beginning, nobody cared about the book. They figured it was just going to get canceled, so they let us do whatever we wanted. And it was, like, the ideal scenario for me because Matt and I could just goof around and I could throw all sorts of kooky ideas at him and we could sneak in our dirty jokes and do all that stuff because it really didn't matter. And then, lo and behold, the book refused to die, which was fantastic.
And it's funny because Deadpool, I guess, I'm really from that point on, is turned into one of those characters that, I mean, some people don't like him, but other people are, they're rabid fans of that character. What do you think it is about him?
Oh, he's great. I mean, certainly the comedy goes a long way. I mean, anytime you've got a funny hero, and then the fact that he's an anti-hero and he's so messed up, he feels a lot of, like, really relatable stuff, like, we're not going out shooting guys in the face, but we'd all like to. And at least at Deadpool, when I was working on him, he was always struggling between doing the right thing but invariably screwing up. Like, he was just so dark and so twisted and knew it that despite his best efforts, he would always, like, make the wrong choice, And I think a lot of us feel that way. And then you hide it with the humor and, try to get by and have his twisted little friends. There's a lot to see from your own life in that character. And then even just down to the physicality of it, I mean, so many of us, like, we don't feel so pretty. And there's Deadpool, with his only feels like his face is on when he's wearing his mask and that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot to relate to. And again, he really was a cipher. Like, he was a pretty open character. So we were able to, carve out a whole history for him, and fans saw that evolve. Like, so many superheroes we come to now, and we just sort of take it for granted. Like, we already know Spidey's history. We already know Superman's origin. Like, this is somebody you could sort of watch and discover as you're going along. I think that carries a lot of weight.
Mm-hmm. And then I guess you ended up on X-Men. You were on X-Men, and Steve Siegel was on Uncanny. That's right? And then you guys walked away from it, which seems to me like a pretty ballsy move to do at that point. What was that like for you guys? I mean, were you like terrified to do it, or you just, this is what we've got to go?
Yeah, I was totally terrified. I don't want to make it sound bigger than it was, because really it was not that huge a deal, but it was the kind of moment that for Steve and I both kind of defined how we were going to look at our own careers, because, we thought we were doing a pretty good job on X-Men. People seemed to like it. Editorial kind of came in a couple times and asked us to change stories, and, we would put up a fight. I mean, we would fight for the ideas that we really liked, and it came to a point where they asked us, they said, hey, listen, we don't really want to argue about the next big event that's going to happen, so we're going to tell you the story, and you guys just execute it. And that's a totally legit way to write stories. I mean, we've always said that. I mean, that's how a lot of TV works, right? There's some, like, the head showrunner, and they tell you what's going on, and then you work out your part. But it wasn't what we signed on for. Mm-hmm. So so we felt like we had to leave. And because of, being on that high-profile book and stuff, we just felt like that would mean also sort of leaving the contract too, because at the time I was exclusive, because it just seemed to sort of fit, you know, like it's kind of hard to walk away from the flagship book and then be like, and now I'll do that other book over there kind of deal. So,
but I mean, was that the Bob Harris regime as opposed to Quesada, right? Or is that, was
yeah.
it before? Yeah. So, yeah. But you still didn't really do much work at Marvel for a while.
No, I mean, that was it. I mean, I left the contract and, you know, actually I quit 2 months before my daughter was born. And it was, you know, it was one of those conversations at home where it was like, all right, look, I don't know if this is a good idea or not. And thank God my wife's the kind of person who's like, look, you know, you got to be happy and you got to believe in what you're doing. And I'm okay with that. And luckily, you know, it worked out pretty well. Cause shortly after that, I was contacted by, Eddie Braganza to work on Superman, and Jeff Loeb also, who was, you know, who called me up first. But Eddie actually really liked Uncanny X-Men and wanted to hire Steve, but he got us confused. So he hired me kind of on the strength of Steve's work. I found that out many months later.
That's funny, because when we were in at WonderCon, Joe Casey kept getting congratulated for I Kill Giants. So.
That bastard.
Oh, yeah, wonderful.
Casey and I have been linked together on each other's projects really pretty much since the day I started writing.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so, you know, it worked out good. And then, you know, once things started going well at DC, I was super busy and then dove into a contract pretty quick.
Cool. And I guess the Superman or Action 775, which you sort of mentioned earlier, that's totally like, I had never read Superman regularly. I still don't, but like to this day, that's like one of my favorite Superman issues I've ever read. Like when you look back on it now, you were talking about looking at it and seeing that there's not actually a lot of action in it, but when you were doing it, did you feel like, hey, I'm doing a really good book here? Or, I mean, did you know? Cause like, it's like a big, you can still say Action 775, who goes, oh, that one, you know?
No, you know, it happened really quickly, you know, in putting it together. I mean, it was sort of like, all right, we need to do an anniversary, and how about you and Doug? And what? And I, you know, I kept saying, Eddie, like, I don't really know what I want to do. And then once in a while, like, I mean, I like everything I'm doing while I'm doing it for the most part, but once in a while you get hit with something that you're like, you really want to write, like you sort of have a drive to write it, and this was one of those stories. And so when I wrote it, I thought it was pretty strong. I was pretty proud of it. I never thought it was going to have the impact that it did. Mm-hmm. That was a total shock to me. But you know, I think anytime a writer feels like they've got something to say, they're not just telling a cool story, it helps, it helps drive them. And it certainly does with me. You know, especially now, like having done this for a while, I feel like if I don't have that sort of heart behind it, I have a tough time writing this stuff. I mean, you can only write like somebody punching somebody so many times. Like, you really gotta be into it and believe in the characters and believe in the motivations and stuff. So 775 is one of those stories, and it, you know, just was kind of burning for me to write it, and I wrote it really fast, which is also always another sign of, oh yeah, I'm on the right track, because I can write quick when I have a fire on my ass, and I did, and I'm super proud of it. I'm still proud of it, you know, like I said, having just reread it, even though it's I didn't realize how much stuff was sort of not on the page. It's more like spoken about, but it's a good story. I'm proud to have written it.
Why did you go back and read it recently?
I don't think I could officially say, but
oh, okay,
it might be, you know, incorporated into some other media.
Cool. All right. So I guess speaking of like sort of having the passion to do something, I think the thing that's making sort of the most at least critical waves recently is I Kill Giants, book that ended in the series ended in January or February, I think, and then the trade just came out, and it's turning into one of those books. It's one of those books that people are talking about, and it, you know, we made it our book of the month, and as you read down, you know, the comments of the people who read it, like, it's emotionally affecting all of these people.
Cool.
I mean, have you ever been involved with, have you ever done a project that sort of had that kind of an impact on people across the board?
Gosh, I mean, you know, the 775 probably is the closest thing to it, you know, and it was quite a while ago. I mean, once in a while, you know, we'll do something where it does have a lot of heart and, you know, with the mainstream characters, and you get a lot of good feedback, but the Giants' response really has been overwhelming, and it's meant so much to me. I mean, that project, it came from such a personal place, and it took so long for it to get done. It came out, it's one of the only books I put out that actually did come out monthly, but it was put together. I wrote it years ago. I mean, I literally had the script finished and had been sitting on it and kind of waiting, for the right person. And the fact that that patience and faith has paid off really, really means a lot to me. And it's just, and your guys' support has been fantastic. And it's just been great. And it's eye-opening too when you sort of it's meaningful to you. I sit there and, I can't tell you how many times I've reread that script or I'd look at the pages and I'd get all weepy. And I knew the story. And I was like, God, I hope I'm not just an idiot sitting here crying, because I'm going to feel really dumb if nobody else thinks this is a good story. And so it's been super gratifying to hear, what an impact it's had on people.
Well, that brings up one of the big questions I had. It's a really personal story, and from reading your commentary in the back of the book, I know it's about personal loss and everything, and but it's not autobiographical. It's not a memoir. So where did the idea come about to sort of fuse something really personal with this fictional story and a fantasy story too?
It came from a few places. My daughter, I guess at the time was about, she was about six. And, I always tell people I'm like a shallow writer. Whatever comes in, I sort of immediately throw on the page. And so I had been noodling around like projects to do about my daughter. And about, around the same time, my dad had diabetes for a while, but the sickness had really started to get to him. So he went through the process, a really long, like ridiculous process that ultimately resulted in him losing a leg. And it was so bizarre. It's one of those first times where, my dad had been in the hospital quite a few times with some, nasty things, but this was so protracted and he was so much older, and it just felt like, wow, this is about as close as I really want to get to, to losing a parent. And I was taking him to physical therapy and just started having this idea about, what would it be like if my daughter had to go through this, but, not actually her, but a sort of heightened version of her, maybe a little bit older and, with a smart mouth and a kid who sort of saw things from a different perspective, because my daughter's very imaginative and really expressive, and she always has acted much older than she really was. So she sort of laid the foundations for Barbara. And again, like I said before, I wrote 775 fast. In this one physical therapy session, while I was sitting waiting in the lobby, I outlined the whole story. I figured it out really fast, and then just began the slow process of writing it. And so that was really where it came from. So it is, it comes from a really, really personal place. But like you said, it's not autobiographical per se. Mm-hmm. And then, during the course of getting the book done and finally getting it published, my dad actually did finally pass away because of diabetes, and it was just as the book was getting ready to come out. It was, I guess he had passed away pretty early in the year, so then it was a few months later that it was coming out. But I was working on it, obviously, that whole time. So it was really a lot of the, dialogue changes or things that I would sort of do last second on a book were heavily influenced by what was going on there. So, it really does come from a, like I said, really personal place.
One of the things you said is you'd had it for a while before you had an artist for it. What did you have in mind for the kind of art that you wanted, and how close was Ken Nomura's work to what you had in mind?
I don't think he'll mind my saying this. One of the first people I spoke to about it was Pasquale Ferri. Mm-hmm. Because Pasquale and I have been friends for so long, and I love, love, love his work, but he draws kids like nobody's business. He's so good with kids and sort of magic. And I thought, wow, he'd knock it out of the park. And I actually have, maybe we'll put it in hardcover or something. I actually have a cover he did, mm-hmm. sort of a quick sketch you know, fake mock-up cover that we used as a poster in San Diego one year. But he got his exclusive at Marvel close to about the time when I was really ready to get going. And so it just became a perpetual, like, oh, could you work on it? No, I can't, you know, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, so he was sort of my starting ground. And then I had a couple of other people who I met during the course of time, and it didn't quite work out with them. Because, again, I had the whole thing written already. And having not done a book through Image yet, I wasn't really sure exactly how, like, if people were going to get paid, if they weren't going to get paid, or any of that sort of stuff. So it was pretty much whoever was doing it on spec, and that certainly causes its own problems too. So then I met Ken. I was at a convention in Spain, and we sat next to each other signing, and he had done a collection of strips and comics he had done in Spain, and I thought it was beautiful, and he had so many different styles, like this this book that he put out there. I keep telling him he's got to do it out here, but so many different styles, from like fine art style to like crazy manga stuff. And you know, I asked him if he'd be interested. So once he looked me up and realized I wasn't like just some crazy chucklehead, he was like, "Oh, I love steampunk. Yeah, I'd like to work with you." So we started talking about what Barbara would look like and what my original idea for her was, and he said, you know, I'd like to do a manga style if that's okay. And I had never thought of the book in that way at all. So it was one of these like leap of faith deals, and I was like, you know, show me what you think it's going to be like. And he started handing in designs, and Barbara got a little bit older than I had originally thought. I think in the original script she's 9 or 10. But more than one person had said to me, you know, you might want to age her up a little bit. She's just too smart mouth. Like, nobody's going to ever believe that, you know, this is a 9-year-old. And I said, well, you should meet my daughter. But so he started doing designs, and it was really clicking. And again, because she was based on my daughter, originally she was just going to have this like crazy tangle of like big curly hair. And he said, you know, I can't make this work because we're going to do it in black and white. It looks like spaghetti. It's not going to be color, you know, so let me try something different. And that was when he started with the rabbit ears. And he said, you know, I just figured, like, A, it's a manga thing, but it's something that would set her apart. You're doing the hair to show that she's unique and she's a loner and that sort of thing. So we'll just do the same thing with crazy hats. Mm-hmm. And we'll never mention it in the book. It's the way she is. So you don't know if it's how she sees herself or if she's really wearing these things. And that was it. I mean, at that point I was totally hooked. I was like, this guy's got it. He's so in tune with this character and like what she's all about. And Ken is an insane designer. Like, he goes through so much work on a book. I think doing the hardcover version for France almost killed him. I mean, like, he's so meticulous that you really like his style is so loose and fluid. But that actually comes from like 4 or 5 drafts that you don't get to see any of the magic, where he just works his butt off. And he's got like the entire school laid out. He's got her whole house laid out. Like, he had all these things done so he could pick shots, work very quickly after that part. He's a really, really meticulous guy. So I just, once I started seeing, you know, his designs for Barbara and for the Giants, like in their final version, I was sold. I knew this guy could knock it out of the park. And never disappointed me once, you know, and such a pleasure to work with. And if I ever needed something tweaked, you know, we'd talk about it. 5 seconds later, it was done. Yeah, it was just a dream.
But I guess it wasn't sort of the look that you originally had in mind, but it worked out in the end.
Absolutely.
That's
absolutely
cool.
My long way of saying that, you know, sometimes what you first start out with, it's okay to let it go. And obviously I'm really glad I did. Ken is really, he's going to turn out to be a superstar. I mean, he really is. And I'm so glad that I got to work with him, you know, at this point in his career, and to sort of learn from him as well as, you know, give him something that I think is pretty strong to draw. And just his storytelling and everything about it, it really made the project incredible.
Cool. I lost my train of thought. I can cut that out, though, so it's fine.
There you go. Make yourself sound good.
Yeah, I'll just swear randomly. No, I guess doing a book for Image is sort of a new thing for you, I guess, because you've worked in the mainstream, you know, the DC and Marvel for most of your career up to that point. Was it like a big shift, I guess, to be in charge of you know, everything, basically? You don't have an editor, or did you? I don't know. But, I mean, you're the one.
I'd had a few friends read the script and give me comments, which was really helpful. Actually, Joe's wife, Megan, mm-hmm. gave me probably the best notes of anybody. And it was actually because of her there's more sort of visions with the various fairies and creatures and stuff than there was in the first time I did a draft. But, I didn't have an editor per se. I learned a lot, certainly, you know, in the process that I just assumed like certain things were going to be taken care of, and they weren't, which was fine. It was just my assumptions. It wasn't because anything the guys at Image weren't doing. But it was great. It was fantastic. And I mean, I like working with an editor. You know, I really am not one of these writers who feels like my vision is the end all be all and mm-hmm. my word is law. It's just not how I work. I love bouncing ideas off of people. I'd much rather talk than write anyway, so, you know, and when I get to, you know, just BS about a story, I'm really happy. And luckily I was able to get that a lot of that with Ken, you know, because of the way we chose to put the book out by doing the individual issues instead of just going right to a graphic novel, I had to reconfigure the whole book into 24-page chapters.
Did you write it as one big piece straight
across?
Yeah,
originally it was just one graphic novel. Mm-hmm. And rightfully I was convinced to chop it up because those individual issues essentially give you 7 months of word of mouth, mm-hmm. you know, instead of like just having this one book that, you know, 500 people might have tried. It's slowly built over time. So when the trade finally comes out, you know, I think we're going to sell out of that first printing kind of any day now. And we'll, you know, that word of mouth has finally grown. It's been growing for almost a whole year. So, so we had to redo it. And talking to Ken about what worked, what didn't work, that was where the, you know, the collaboration came in. And
well, it must have been a pretty successful book. It's hard to tell with indie books and stuff like that. But I mean, you're going, the trade is impossible to find apparently, and there's a hardcover coming out. So, I guess it went well.
Yeah, you know, I find it hard to judge also. I don't know. I mean, my expectations for the Image books, you know, you get a good strong dose of reality. Not that you never know what like weight your name carries or any of that kind of stuff. But really, none of that has to do with anything. It has to do with just sort of the market in and of itself. Like, you know, retailers just sort of unwilling to take chances on small sure. books and that kind of thing. So that was a steep learning curve for me. But all that now, having gotten past it, I think Giants is going to turn out to be a pretty big success, and certainly, you know, by my standards, it was exactly what I was hoping for. Because again, you know, Loeb used to always yell at me because whenever we were talking about Superman, he'd be like, "Oh, have you seen the numbers?" And I would say, you know, I really honestly don't want to know what the numbers are. And you know, he would freak out. I'm like, I can't think that way, because if I start thinking that way, I'm not going to make the same choices. And I want to hit home runs? Yes, I would love I Kill Giants to sell a million copies. Like, nothing would make me happier. But when I saw the first numbers and like, okay, this is going to be a low selling book, I was okay with that. You know, it was just like, because I wrote the story I wanted to write, and I do believe, and I feel like my career has sort of borne it out, that you do find your audience. Like, no matter what kind of book you're writing, you will find your audience. That audience might not always be huge, but like you're saying about the Deadpool fans, they will be rabid. Mm-hmm. And that's who I want. I'll take 100 rabid fans over 10,000 Fairweather fans any day of the week. Any day of the week. So, you know, hopefully Giants will be one of those that'll have that rabid base and then start to expand out.
Speaking of rabid fans, you're also doing a run on Amazing Spider-Man right now.
Yeah.
Which is literally, it's like the polar opposite.
Yeah.
and am I correct? Like, you've never written a significant amount of Spider-Man in the past, so this is sort of your first.
Yeah, this is definitely it. The only thing I had ever done was a web slingers, like a three-part story about Pete going to the prom, and fighting the Sandman. That was very very moving. But yeah, this is it. The big Spidey show, and it's been a lot of fun.
It feels like you have a real knack for the character. I mean, did you feel like it came pretty easily?
after a lot of like gut wrenching and worrying that I would not be good for the character, then yeah, it's worked out pretty good. But I love Spider-Man so much. Like, I really am sort of a goofball fanboy when it comes to Spidey, and not in the land of I've been reading it since I was a kid and that sort of thing. But the majority of my childhood reading was Spider-Man, and I loved him so much, and loved all those cartoons, those horrible cartoons. everything about Spidey, like, he was my superhero. So when the opportunity came to work on him, I was really, really intimidated. And I'm still kind of intimidated, just because I don't want to mess him up, But it's been really fun, and, I can bust out a joke here or there, so.
A lot of them. Now, in the storyline that you're working on, basically, there's a lot of crossover with the Dark Avengers and stuff like that, which kind of struck me, since it felt like Spider-Man was sort of existing on his own, outside of everything else that was happening on. But I guess I'm wondering, with the way that Spider-Man is coming out now, it's sort of weekly, and there's a whole lot of teams coming on it. Like, how do you go about pitching your story? Like, or how much of it is, I guess, preordained by editorial? Or,
well, it's been great. The guys, the rest of the guys on the team who were there before me, they did all the heavy lifting of the Brand New Day stuff. That was a major, major challenge. And obviously, we all know the reactions, both good and bad. And it was so controversial. And they did it. And, kind of went through a whole year with the stories. And then basically I came in. Mm-hmm. So they had done all this heavy lifting. And the first, the Hammerhead story, when I came in, I just had an idea. I was just, putting my toe in the water. I was like, I just want to do Hammerhead because he was scary when I was a kid. So I'd like to make a scary Hammerhead. And then we've had two Spider-Man conferences kind of since then. And they're really open. The editorial team is great, really open to ideas. And they were definitely working in a bubble for a while. And, since I've been around, that bubble has popped. I mean, you could only sort of, keep Spidey to yourself for so long. But that's cool because it gives you more opportunities to sort of play with those other, now you can play with their characters too.
I was surprised because it was like, oh, it's all the Dark Avengers and everything going on too. I think I just didn't really expect that whole thing.
Once Norman's in the mix and since he's so plugged into that world, it was kind of a, I had to play with those guys. But it was cool because, I love Bullseye as a character, so he's a lot of fun. And, the Dark Wolverine there is a lot of fun too. So, these are characters that I wanted to mess around with. And once we knew it was going to be kind of a mega brawl, I was happy to get my fingers on those guys.
Cool. Four Eyes is another one that you said it's coming out sort of sporadically, which, by the way, I'm fine with because it's a beautiful book. That's not the point. I guess where did this one come from? Because I Kill Giants. You explained the story about that, and it's funny, but between I Kill Giants and on the Spider-Man stuff and Four Eyes, I wouldn't be able to tell you that the same guy wrote these.
Well,
which I guess
good.
Is a compliment.
It's a compliment to me. It's also it's something that it's like a yoke that sometimes people have to bear too. It's like, and I'm comfortable with that. I mean, people sort of ask me, how come you don't just do all one kind of thing? I just can't. I'm not hardwired that way. And if I can jump from genres to character types and stuff and people still like them, then I'm really happy. I've been reading all these old Osamu Tezuka books, and that's what this guy did. I mean, he just jumped from everything. Like, so many people know him for Astro Boy, but he did some of the darkest, scariest crap that you could ever read. Andy did this really inspirational, Buddha, I love all his stuff. So it's a real model and inspiration for me, just sort of as a map of a career. But Four Eyes really was literally one of those ideas that I just kind of had an image popped in my head of this barefoot kid with a dragon by the Brooklyn Bridge. And
that's
on the
all
cover. I knew. I really didn't know what else was there, and I was like, well, I guess since he's barefoot, I he's poor, so maybe he's in the Depression. And that was kind of it. And it was sort of swiftly followed with the idea of Tommy guns and stuff. So I was like, yeah, okay, I'm going to do it in the 30s. And that was really all I knew. And sort of letting it sit and kind of ruminating on it, it became a story about revenge and the idea that there was this underground dragon fighting ring in the Depression. And it was a way that people sort of, you know, blew off steam and got their anger and frustration out, but it was illegal because the dragons were actually endangered species. And it just sort of came from there. It's definitely, it's one of those weird, it's a weird concept that, like, kind of works on a gut level, like on a really weird, like, instinct level. And so I'm sort of discovering the story as I go along, which it's kind of how I used to write. You know, comics, one thing that comics are great for is that because they have to come out so quickly, you stay very focused on structure, and you tend to write, like, in a straight line. Like, I need to know where I'm going for the next couple of months, so let me make sure I hit all my points, and I've got my act one, act two, act three. But I used to write, like when I was going to school, where I would just have like an idea, like I would see an image, and I don't know what that is, but let me write it down. And then I'd have another one, next thing you know, you'd have like 10 scenes, and they started to tell a story. And that's what Four Eyes was. And for me, that's an exciting way to write. And that was it. And then, thank God I found Max Jumar, because he is unbelievable. Unbelievable talent.
Yeah, it's kind of stupid. He's really that good.
It's true. And, you know, I keep cannibalizing for myself with Max, because he's so awesome, and I want to work with him all the time. Like, he's got a couple of pages in the Amazing 600, because they're like, oh, we need somebody to do a five-page story. I'm like, oh, get Max. And that Outlaw Territory collection is coming out this month. We did an eight-page story in that, too, because he's just so brutally talented. It's I can't stand it. And again, here is a guy who, you know, I told him, here's this crazy idea. You can do whatever style you want, because, you know, he had, for DC, been doing sort of more photorealistic stuff. And I said, you know, you can loosen it up a little bit, because he had sent, like, a Christmas card out that was really, like, fun and bouncy and not at all, you know, grounded in sort of photoreal stuff. And I was like, you know, play like that. Like, you can go a little more expressionistic. And as soon as he drew Enrico the first time, I was like, that's a home run. This is the guy. Because I knew he could do horror. I had seen some of his horror stuff. So I knew he'd have no problems with monsters and dragons and guts and that kind of thing. But it was this idea of, could you do like a sort of cartoony kid, but in a real Brooklyn? And he, you know, nailed it, and nails it every panel.
Yeah, I mean, I think you said he was Brazilian? Or
he's that, no, Argentinian.
Argentinian. Yeah. I am South American challenged. Now, I mean, but the city feels, so, I mean, are you sending him tons of photo reference or something like that? Because, I mean, like, the New York City in the 30s, like, it feels so authentic and sort of dirty. And
it's that. Yeah, he's done a ton of research. I know he's bought a few books, mm-hmm. and, you know, obviously the internet gives us access to so much stuff. He came up here last year, I think, and, you know, I know he took a lot of pictures, too. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, he's very dedicated to, you know, to doing the research and staying on top of it. And anytime I find something, I send it. But he's got that uncanny ability to just reproduce anything he sees, you know, immediately. I mean, I just had him do something in a subway, and it looks like a photo. I mean, it's mm-hmm. crazy.
And this is ostensibly an ongoing, I guess?
Yeah, Four Eyes it's definitely got an end point. And it's one of these stories that, as long as we're having fun, and as long as the, you know, we always talk about the dragon fights, as long as the fights, you know, are not feeling repetitive, you know, we're happy to do it for a long time, but it definitely has an end point. So I think the current goal right now is to try to hit it at a 25-issue series, because we really want to see Enrico, you know, claw his way along this path of revenge that he's going to get onto. And we have a ton of stuff. I mean, there's a lot of, even just in these first couple of issues that have come out, there's a lot of characters who are introduced, and they all have a cool backstory, and they're all linked. And I think 25 feels really good. You know, when we set out to do Steampunk was going to be 50, and that was sort of my first stab at, like, okay, here's a creator-owned, like, big epic thing. And 50's a lot. I mean, you're asking, you know, you're asking a lot from people. So 25, I think, is a pretty reasonable goal. And, you know, for the amount of work that Max puts into it, we really can't turn around super fast. So that'll be plenty of time. But he's really committed. And, you know, if we have to do it shorter, we'll do it shorter. But it's one of those stories where act two is sort of expandable or contractible, you know, depending on what you want to do. But we're both, you know, really committed to it, and he's working really hard. So I appreciate that, you know, at least people know that it's a good-looking book. And Nestor, who's the caller, he does an amazing job, too.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
They're just they're a great team. So I hope people, you know, will stick it out. The goal, we're doing the first arc is the first four issues. So after that comes out, we'll do a trade of that. And then hopefully that'll sort of buy us time to stockpile a few and then release the next arc, you know, monthly.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to be done in arcs, and then we'll take a break, and there'll be a trade, and then we'll do another arc, that kind of thing.
It's a long view project, though.
It's definitely a long view project, and it's one that I can tell you we both really want to see completed, because I love these characters, and Max really loves them. And Max, has honestly told me, like, he's turned down some other stuff to do Four Eyes, which I deeply, deeply appreciate.
Yeah. Now between, I guess, Enrico and Barbara, and then you have the Douglas Fredericks book come out, you've got a lot of kids in your work.
Right.
I mean, is that something that's changing for you as a writer, or, you know, because you have kids, or?
Well, like I said, I'm pretty shallow, so it's, the kids are around. No, you know, it's, again, some of these projects have been sitting around a long time. Like Douglas, I wrote a very long time ago, and Ben drew it a long time ago. That book has actually been finished for well over a year. I think that book has been finished for maybe almost 2 years. And because of not really knowing what I was doing at the time, like I wasn't sure who was putting it out yet, I had a friend of mine who's a graphic designer was putting the book together for me, and she did an amazing job on the book. That took a little bit of time because she was sort of helping me out while keeping her business afloat.
Mm-hmm.
And then because of some internal stuff about how we were going to sell the book, it went through format changes that took a long time. So that's why this book is also coming out at the same time. But yeah, I wrote it. I wanted to do a kid's book. I was reading way too many children's books that were driving me nuts because though they were lovely, they were kind of insipid. And I just think that you can, you know, be a little subversive in your children's literature. And that's what I was going for with Douglas. I mean, Douglas is really about a kid questioning authority and being sort of, you know, getting the smackdown for it. Like, you're not supposed to ask, you know, this is what they say, and you've got to do what they say. And he's a kid who asks why. And that's the sort of lesson that I would like to pass along to my kids. So that was why I wrote it.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, as far as like a paradigm shift, like, definitely not. I mean, Bang Tango is...
Well, yeah, that brings me to, I guess... Yeah.
Let's get into the filth.
Yeah, let's deal with more filth.
There's as much like angelic love and nasty filth currently coming out from me on the shelves that I hope they balance each other out.
Is that something you find necessary as a writer to have two completely different, you know, tones going on as you're writing? Like to have something more, you know, gritty and adult where you're doing the kid stuff on the other side?
Yeah, I don't know if it's it's not that conscious. It's more like what stuff kind of bubbles up and, you know, sort of asks, you know, to get written first. I mean, I always hate to sound like sort of hoity-toity about it, but that is how it goes with this stuff because it takes a lot of time, and especially when you're working on something, you know, for free that you're hoping to sell later, you know, or you're just going to self-publish, that you really have to love this stuff. And so sometimes really fun ideas just get pushed aside, and, you know, it's the one that kind of is crying out the loudest. And sometimes that'll be like, oh, you just did something light and fluffy. You need to get dirty now. You know? But I'm never that conscious about it. It's not like, if anything, it's counterproductive to my long-term career that I keep putting out schizophrenic books. You know, it's like the Bang Tango audience probably isn't going to pick up Douglas Fredericks or vice versa.
Well, you're sort of a one-stop shop for the family.
if you're schizophrenic, I'm definitely your one-stop shop.
Like if there's a deviant father and a lovely child, then you've got them covered.
Yeah, there you go.
When you're sitting down to script during the day, could you write Bad Dog on the same day as you're writing, you know, something like I Kill Giants or Four Eyes? Like, or is it, it has to be a different day?
Just because of the necessity of deadlines and stuff, a lot of times I do multiple projects in a day, but it's helpful if I can stack them that they're sort of in the same corner of the spectrum. But I've done it. I've definitely done it where I've like proofed out Douglas and then worked on Tango or something. It's strange.
So where does Bad Dog come from?
Bad Dog, you know, when Man of Action decided like, hey, we're going to do our books and we're going to do them through Image, and I was getting gung-ho about it. You know, so a lot of the books were like beginning, middle, end books. And, you know, I knew that they were a complete story, and I didn't really have any, like, open-ended, ongoing ideas. So I was like, well, what would be fun? And I just said, you know, I want to do, like, the most self-indulgent book. Like, I want to just do a book that's only about stuff I like. And I love werewolves. I've always loved werewolves. I love drinking. And I like, you know, violence and foul-mouthed characters. So that was kind of it. I was like, all right, let's put them all together and see what it is. And I was really heavily inspired by Preacher. I mean, my sort of, you know, like, I think we all go through stages as a fan where you read, like, superhero books for a while, and then maybe you go find something else for a while. And my most recent, you know, like I was saying, I was reading the Vertigo books kind of as I was going to school. Preacher was, you know, the first book that, like, caught my eye, and I was like, what the hell is that? Because I hadn't been in the comic store for a while, and obviously I was hooked and loved it and, you know, was living and breathing that book. So it was definitely like, oh, I want to do my Preacher. Like, that's what I want to do. So Bad Dog was sort of, you know, and I, not to say it's as good as Preacher, but, I mean, that's kind of where it came from. And I, you know, the thematically, all the stuff that's in that book, too, is, you know, the stuff that I worry about kind of on a daily basis. Like, Lou as a character is wondering whether or not he's wasting his life, you know, and it's the kind of question that I'm always faced with. Like, am I doing the right thing? Am I looking at the right project? Am I, you know, like you asked before, like, should I have been a screenwriter instead of a comic book writer? You know, these are that kind of questioning and the existential questions that come up. That's what Bad Dog's really about, beneath the foul mouth and nasty sex. And
don't tell anyone that. You can't sell it on the existential angst.
Yeah, exactly. It's, we like to sneak it in there.
This is already getting too heavy. It's,
yeah. Well, you know, and there's a guy who drinks a lot of bourbon, and
there you go.
Got a midget friend who passes out and girls pickpocket him. And,
well, what's funny is that, like, that book is it's much more interesting than I think I expected it to be, probably for that same reason. Like, you've got the one character who's filthy and disgusting, but you know, Lou is actually sort of sweet, you know, in a way. And it's kind of, it's interesting. Like, there's a heart there that I don't think that I initially expected, because obviously, like, when you read the pitch, it's like, he's a bad werewolf.
Right.
You know? So I guess that worked out fairly well.
I think
it's
probably the sweetest book I've read that features a talking head in a refrigerator. It's a big juxtaposition there, but
that is a quote that I want on the back of the book.
Yeah,
I mean, again, it's really like the stuff that's in it. You know, I love I just love broken characters. Like, I like characters who are so off track, and it's, I like them even more if they know it. Like, they know that they're totally, totally messed up, and that's all this book is. I mean, pretty much everyone in it, you know, they're running from something, or their life has collapsed, and they've just tried to make something new of themselves, but it doesn't work. You know, this is a book about, like, lots of broken people trying to make sense of things. And in a lot of ways, it's like going back to Deadpool for me. Mm-hmm. You know, I think you'll see this sort of, there's some similarities in the cast, just sort of in the construction of it, which I think I haven't even really thought about until now. But, you know, guys who want to do the right thing but can't, people who just don't care and really just want to get drunk and be debaucherous, you know, it's like those guys are all in that Deadpool stuff, too. And so, yeah, so there's a lot of heart, but there's a lot of foulness, which I think works out pretty well.
I think that describes all of us.
No, so with all these diverse different stories, then, is that maybe, like, one of those unifying themes that you were talking about, like, that's something that interests you, and that's what connects all of these stories? It's more a thematic connection than, you know, the elements involved?
That's a great question. I mean, I definitely, I always try to go for the emotional story, and it's just the way, it's the way I'm hardwired. Like, I can't, you know, like, just to jump back to Spider-Man for a second, when that story came up in the room, that I was not gung-ho to do the American Sun story. I mean, it was really just put up there as like, all right, you want Spidey and Norman to go head-to-head, you know, who's going to do it? And that was the farthest thing from my mind. I was thinking about some other story. And I sort of got it by default. And I was like, guys, you know, I'm not really sure, like, you know, what to do. And it wasn't until somebody said, it's the last temptation of Harry Osborn, that I got it. Like, then I was like, oh, this is about, you know, Pete and his friendship and his inability to trust Harry to make his own good decision. That's really what it is, because if Pete had just said, like, well, Harry, good luck with that, like, the story would be a totally different thing. Mm-hmm. He just can't do it. He doesn't trust him. He doesn't trust his friend to make his own good decision. That I could get, like, that kind of heart I understood. And then the rest of it is fun. Like, then I can do guys in armor punching each other and stuff. And so all these books have that. I mean, it's, you know, Four Eyes is, you know, it's a revenge story, and what happens when a kid is sort of dragged through this really, really dark world for a dark reason? Is he going to become a monster? And obviously it's embodied in these dragons and, you know, this sort of the life of crime that, you know, he's been pulled into. And Bad Dog is definitely like broken people trying to make good. And can they, you know, will the world let them be good? Yeah, I mean, that's, it definitely pulls them all together. Tango, too, is definitely very, very broken people.
Yes.
yeah, and, you know, so that those emotional strings are the ones that really pull me. And I think you'll see even in stuff that's coming down the pike, like Ken and I are going to be doing this drama next that doesn't really have, you know, like Giants has got sort of magical realism elements to it. This one's a pretty straight drama with some, you know, some over-the-top characters. And but again, it's this heightened reality of these broken people trying to make good on their lives, you know? Yeah, that's the stuff that I really respond to.
Cool. Jesus, I think we covered all of your books. I don't know how that happened, but what kind of a writer are you, like, on a day-to-day basis? Are you scripting, like, a lot of the time, or how busy are you with stuff? Because a lot of this stuff you said had been written before, but are you always working on new concepts and stuff? Or are you still working in animation?
Oh yeah, I mean, I bang all over the place. I'm not as rigidly disciplined as I need to be. So what ends up happening is I sort of grand a lot. I sort of get loose ideas and kind of let them germinate for a while, and then somebody calls and needs something, and then I freak out, and then I write stuff. The act of putting things on the page is definitely like the most painful for me. But I'm here basically all day, you know, in the chair, with the occasional schedule thrown off because of kids and family stuff. But you know, the real writing for me comes at really unexpected times, like just the other day I was working on Four Eyes 4, and it was on a train ride to Manhattan, and I figured out, you know, whatever, two-thirds of the book on this particular ride. Like, it had been in there, and I had been kind of like trying to consciously peck at it, but I couldn't do it, and then all of a sudden, there the whole thing was. So
that's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, well, it sucks when it doesn't happen.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that's what I look for, you know, and then it's just, once I've got an outline, then I can sort of write it relatively quickly. Then it's just a matter of, you know, and editors who I've worked with, you know, Steve right now knows when I say, like, all right, I'm in it, I finally figured it out, that usually means it's going to come pretty quick. Mm-hmm. But it's a lot of banging my head against the wall, I got to tell you. I don't know how guys like Bendis do it. Like, I don't know how you can put out that many books a month. That's an incredible sense of discipline that I still don't have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's tough, because sometimes there's that, like, you know you have to do it, but the actual putting it on the page can be just torturous.
Oh, it's the worst.
I use the excuse that I don't like to write during the day.
Nice.
And then I don't have time at night. So yeah. Whatever it takes to not do something,
mm-hmm.
is a wonderful thing. But I guess, you know, you kind of started out, again, you started off with Marvel, where you had deadlines right away, so you didn't have to go through that I have to write for myself thing before anybody notices it. So.
No, definitely. And as a matter of fact, I used to write 4 books a month. I really don't know how I did it. I think I was terrified I was never going to work again. So I was like cranking them out. But now I do so much stuff. And then, you know, Man of Action, between, we have a new show on Cartoon Network. We have other consulting work that we do. Like, we're constantly doing other stuff. So I'm starting to learn now how to write quicker and shorter bursts of time, because inevitably you're going to get pulled to something else, you know? Mm-hmm. Casey's actually great at that. Casey had always said he could write like 1 page a day of 5 different projects, and at the end of the month he'd have 5 scripts, and he could do it.
I remember talking to him one day, and I was like, so how much do you work in a given day? And he's like, maybe I write maybe 2 hours. And I was like, you asshole.
Yeah.
You horrible jerk. How did the four of you guys come together? Was it just that you were all working, I guess, on Xbox at the time, or?
Yeah, that was pretty much it. I met Duncan on the Juggernaut one shot, and we hit it off just as buddies. And then Steve and I, you know, met doing the X-Men and
holding a revolution.
And
holding a revolution.
and those guys all kind of knew each other, from the scene out there in L.A. And we just, we liked each other. We worked together a lot in the X office, and then migrated to DC also, and did the same work on Superman, and then had an opportunity to work on the X-Men video game. And Joe was like, I don't know how to do this myself, why don't we all work on it? And that was kind of it. That was how we started the company. And we were already working together anyway. We were talking all the time, and we were helping each other out with stories and talking about projects. So that was the beginning of the company, and then shortly after that, we got Ben 10, and that sort of solidified it.
Yeah, it's funny because you guys like announced that you were a company, I guess, at one point, but it wasn't really clear what that meant. And then like, after a while, of course, Ben 10 is what it is. And mm-hmm. and even in the past, I guess, 6 months, you all had books coming out from Image at the same time. Which is kind of cool. It actually was like, well, this thing didn't go away. It just took a little while to build into something that we all knew what it was, I guess.
No, that's a great point. If we weren't such a bunch of knuckleheads, we probably would have figured it out a little sooner. But it is. It's, when we would tell people, it's a creative think tank and we do comics and animation, people are like, yeah, you're full of shit. But that's really what we've done. And we've somehow managed to make a living at it, for quite a number of years now. And what's great is to sort of have stuff that's a little bit more tangible so that people on the outside can go, oh, I get it. This is what they do. Mm-hmm. So it's great. And, they're a great bunch of guys and everybody's smart. And we push each other to do better, mm-hmm. And you see something you like in somebody else's book and you're like, damn it, now I got to write mine better, that kind of stuff. And it's working out pretty good.
Cool. I think that that's probably all that I've got now. Anything else I think we need to cover? All right.
No, I think we're cool. I appreciate. It's funny. I'd forgotten that you wanted to actually talk this long. I thought all of a sudden I'm like, oh my god, I'm blabbing on about everything.
No,
I thought we were just talking about like giants, but this is great.
No, we do the whole thing. We talk about the writing. We talk about the craft. We do it all. That's
the whole package.
Yeah.
Excellent.
It's the multifaceted approach. We're not unlike a podcasting Man of Action ourselves, because
indeed
we kicked around for years without knowing what we were doing. But anyway,
I was gonna say, yeah, you really don't want to follow our example. Oh man, no, I'm so glad. It's like, it's funny. We've hit that point in our careers, I guess, where it's like, I definitely don't think of myself as an old timer by any stretch, but we're in the journeyman stage, and you get to sort of look and see who's still standing and stuff, and it's very cool. You guys are around; it makes me very happy. Good guys are rising to the top.
So it's interesting because I mean, you came up a little bit before I started reading again, but you were still like, you and Joe and even like Vaughn and Bendis were all guys who were young right when I started reading comics.
Mm-hmm.
And now you're right. You're like the veterans and the journeymen, and it feels like so much has changed since then.
Yeah.
But all the people who were like the new guys when I started are now, the guys, the establishment, which is
right.
Very odd to get used to.
It is a little bit strange, and that's why it's good if we shake ourselves up from time to time, so we don't settle in too much to that establishment role. But it's there's a lot of people who come and go, and it's cool to see, you know, who sticks around, and you know, the work usually stands for itself.
All right, well, thanks so much, Joe. I appreciate it.
This has really been great. I appreciate it.
I want to thank Joe Kelly one more time for spending so much time with us and going all over that stuff. It was a ton of fun. Make sure you check out ifanboy.com to comment on this podcast and read all the other great stuff there, including original columns by Paul Montgomery every single Tuesday and all sorts of other great writers that show up on ifanboy.com. And if you want to send us an email, that's contact@ifanboy.com. Thanks very much, and we'll be back very soon.